So we'll move from 1917, basically through the Holocaust, up to close to 1948. So this is the sixth lesson in our series. We began by looking at two very important basic topics. One of those was the people of Israel. And we found that the people of Israel began basically with an individual named Abraham, when God called him out of Ur and made an unconditional or unilateral covenant with Abraham, making him the promises of a land, a seed, and a worldwide blessing. Following him, Abraham had many children, but the promised child was one who was miraculously born when Sarah's womb was open. She was 90 years old when she had Isaac, and the promises were repeated to him and not to Ishmael or any of other of Abraham's children. So the line narrowed to Isaac. And then to Jacob the promises were made. So Isaac had children as well, Esau and Jacob. They were twins, and yet the promise was made only to Jacob and to his descendants. And he was renamed Israel in Genesis 32. And so that's where we get really the formal beginning of the nation, was with this individual. And this is why we defined a true Israelite, or an Israelite generally speaking, as one who is an offspring of a male descendant of Jacob. So that Jewishness is carried on through the father. And this is why Jesus Christ could be a Jew and yet have Gentile women in his lineage. And so then we went on to define a true Jew or a true Israelite as one who has actually believed in God as Abraham had, or had believed in Jesus as the Messiah. And this is what completes one's Jewishness. Whereas today, in the state of Israel, for example, if a Jew professes to be a Christian, then they are not permitted to be citizens of the state of Israel. That is to, in their view, to cut one off from their Jewishness. To become a Christian for them is to cut themselves off from Jewishness. And so they have a different definition, is what I'm telling you, of what Jewishness is. And that's important to understand the biblical definition of a Jew. The second major area we looked at was the land of Israel. And we said that the key element of the land promises were that they were to be an eternal possession. And yet it has never been possessed eternally. And they certainly don't possess all the land today that was promised to them in Genesis 15, 18 through 21. But if God is faithful, then He must fulfill His promises. And many people say that, no, the land will never be restored to Israel, and that the church has taken over these promises, and it was merely speaking of the eternal heavens and new earth. And that is not what the promises are about. They are not about the new heavens and new earth, but the present heavens and earth. And so this must be their possession eternally. It will, of course, bleed over into the new heavens and new earth, but nevertheless, it starts in this world, in the millennial kingdom. Then we trace the history of Israel as a sovereign nation. This period is from 1445 B.C. at Mount Sinai until 605 B.C. at the exile. Or you could just say Exodus to exile. At Mount Sinai, they received the Mosaic Covenant, which was different from the Abrahamic Covenant. The Abrahamic was unconditional. This one was conditional. In other words, it came in the form of, if you, Israel, do this, then I will do this. And so you have the blessing-cursing motif, which we trace through the Old Testament and used as a model for understanding the Old Testament history of Israel. And we trace this motif through the wilderness wanderings from 1445 to 1405. For 40 years they wandered in the wilderness because they were unfaithful and did not get to cross into the land because of disobedience. Conquest and settlement began under Joshua in 1445 to 1398. So in 7 years they conquered a large portion of the promised land, but not all of it. And everything that they did conquer was on the western side of the Jordan River. Then we enter the period of the Judges in 1368, and that takes us down to 1050 B.C. This didn't work, and most of the people rejected the Judges and did what was right in their own eyes. And then the nation began to ask for kings. And so the period of the kings was from 1050 until 722 BC. The kingdom was divided in 931 BC, so that you had a northern and southern kingdom because they had a civil war. And the northern kingdom fell in 722 BC when they were defeated by the Assyrians, when the nation reached the fifth degree of cursing outlined in Leviticus 26. The southern kingdom lasted much longer. They continued as a sovereign nation until 605 BC, when they also reached the fifth degree of cursing. And just as God promised, due to their disobedience, God exiled from the land. He spewed them out, because God cannot permit sinful people to live within His land. It is His holy land, and Jerusalem is His habitation. And He does not permit sin forever in His land. The land will spew them out. So then they went into exile and became a subservient nation. We studied this history from 605, and it has lasted until 1948 A.D. At first, they were under Babylon from 605 to 536. Then under Medo-Persia from 536 to 332. Then they were governed by Greece from 332, beginning with Alexander the Great, until 63 B.C. Then they were under Rome from 63 B.C. to 324 A.D. Now we're talking about the land. Who controlled the land? Who had rule over the area of the Promised Land? Then we had the Byzantine Empire, which controlled the land from 324 to 638. This was basically the eastern branch of the Roman Empire, which lasted much longer than the western branch. Then came the Arab period, the first one, which was the rise of Islam under Muhammad and the development of this religion, which turned out to be an anti-Jew religion, as we'll find out in next week. Now this was the period in which the Dome of the Rock was built, and which is still there today. It was built about and concluded about 690 A.D. So it's been there for a long, long time. The Arabs love to build on people's holy places. In fact, from when Jerusalem was under the control of the Jordans from 1948 to 1967, one of the oldest graveyard, an ancient graveyard, is on near the Mount of Olives, and they used it as a latrine for 19 years. So they just piss on everything of everybody else's, and that's the way they are. And Genesis 16 says that these descendants are going to be like donkeys. They're going to be in everybody's face, and they don't care about anybody, just their own well-being. So get out of the way. The Crusades began in 1099 and lasted until about 1187. And this is where Richard the Lionheart tried to make an attack in 1189, but he was turned away and it remained under Muslim control. So we get Arab period number 2 from 1187 to 1517 A.D., which was the year of the Reformation, incidentally. Then we went under the Ottoman Empire, and I didn't explain a whole lot about this period of time, but it lasted for 400 years, as you can see. And today we will turn from that period of rule to Britain's rule from 1917 to 1948. So let's back up a little bit into the Ottoman Empire, and then we'll move into the period of British rule. Today I want to talk kind of about some of the major players, the major people, as well as the major events which led up to the foundation of the State of Israel in 1948. Several factors played a key role in planting within the Jewish hearts a desire to return to their land, now known in this day as Palestine. The first thing that happened, which may surprise you, was a French ruler named Napoleon Bonaparte. Now, Napoleon Bonaparte, you know, led them into the French Revolution and was a very progressive and liberal thinker. Bonaparte said, however, "I desire to take every means to ensure the rights which were restored to the Jewish people be not illusory, to find for them a Jerusalem in France." So the Jews attempted to assimilate in the nations in which they lived in Europe. And Bonaparte opened the door in the late 1700s for the Jews to have a home there in France. With this statement, Many Jews, leading Jews in France renounced any need to return to the land of Palestine or Israel. For example, Abraham Furtado said, "We are no longer a nation within a nation. France is our country, Jews. Your obligations are outlined. Your happiness is waiting." So this renouncing of the need for a separate nation set the tone for the Jewish life of the next century, that is the 1800s. Jews across Europe hoped that they could achieve similar results in the nations which they resided. However, it did not, and as hard as the Jews tried to assimilate, they were continually blockaded by their nation, by these nations. For example, they continued to be accused of an ancient accusation of the Catholic Church called blood libel. Blood libel was the accusation that during the time of Passover every year, the Jews would murder Christians and use their blood to bake it into the matzah bread. So this continued to be accused against the Jews. Additionally, another thing that caused a lot of bitterness and strife between the European nations and the Jews was the fact that the Jews were a very small number of people, yet proportionately they had a much higher number of people in high positions of influence. This showed their ability to excel intellectually above and beyond the normal people of these nations. And so, of course, this did not go unnoticed, and it caused a lot of bitter resentment. For example, the Rothschild bankers, who supposedly had plotted to exploit and impoverish all of Catholic Europe, which is just a myth. So despite their best efforts to assimilate in Europe, it was widely believed that no Jew could truly be loyal to the country in which he lived. So there was always this suspicion that the Jews were plotting something and that they could not be loyal to these countries. This became very apparent in the Dreyfus Affair in the around 1894, which I'll explain in a moment, which is a very key event. So for hundreds of years, they had tried to assimilate, and in the history of the world, no such people has ever had difficulty assimilating in another nation. So the question for all of us is, was this just by chance, or was this the providential hand of God in keeping the nation of Israel distinct and pure? So after attempts to assimilate in Europe, we move into a period of heightened anti-Semitism in Europe during the 19th century. They were falsely accused, again, of murdering Catholics in order to drink their blood. They were considered the blood drinkers. They were accused of wrecking economies. Anytime anything went wrong, it was charged to the Jews during this period of history. One of the key things that came about was the publication of a book that you know called The Origin of Species in 1859 by Charles Darwin. Now, you know it by the title Origin of Species, right? Well, here is the entire title of the book or work. On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, or the Preservation of Favored Races and the Struggle for Life. The Preservation of Favored Races and the Struggle for Life. This is a racist document. The evolutionary premise is built on a racist document. This racist book led many to conclude that there was biological proof for the racial superiority of certain peoples, namely tall Aryans with blonde hair and blue eyes, of which the Jew was the opposite, normally short, dark hair, dark eyes. And so this led to the belief of Aryan supremacy, which led to the most horrific form or expression of racism the world had ever seen, in the Holocaust, which began in 1939. Now, so this is another thing that promoted anti-Semitism. Another important element was a document called The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, published in 1894. It came out of Russia. It was a fabricated story meant to convince Nicholas II, who was a weak czar at the time, that his greatest enemy was the Jewish people. And this document made its way into Europe and was widely circulated. Hundreds of thousands of copies were sold, And it became basically what everybody accepted to be as true. The protocols tried to show from reports of an alleged international Jewish Congress, some Jewish Congress out there, that there was a widespread international Jewish movement to destroy existing Christian organizations and to replace them by Jewish world domination. That's what the document is basically about, saying that the Jews were conspiring to take over the world. So by 1919, most people in Europe believed the document to be genuine. In 1921, the London Times published in their paper that the protocols were an outright forgery based on blatant lies, but it was to no avail because it was too late. People had already invested their belief in the protocols, and so it didn't change the movement of anti-Semitism. In fact, anti-Semites today in the 21st century still call on this document, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, in order to propagate their anti-Semitism. In the United States of America, Henry Ford published these papers in his newspaper. Anti-Semitism, which had been rekindled by the medieval Catholic accusations of blood libel, intensified by evolutionary racism and the fabricated protocols of the Elders of Zion, crushed all attempts for the Jews to assimilate in Europe and paved the way for the ultimate act, physical annihilation of a people. But at the same time, it did something else. It planted within the hearts of these Jews Jewish nationalism, the desire for a homeland. And so now we move to the period of rise of Jewish nationalism, which began basically with a key event called the Dreyfus Affair, which lasted for 12 years, 1894 to 1906. Now, this is the key event which gave rise to the political movement which is called Zionism, which would ultimately result in the rebirth of the nation of Israel. In 1894, Alfred Dreyfus, an assimilated Jew in the country of France, was a captain in the French army. He was a wealthy Jew, and he was convicted of treason and sentenced to life in prison on Devil's Island. What basically happened was he was convicted of passing secret army information, French army information, to the Germans. An unsigned letter had been found in a wastebasket by a cleaning lady. Handwriting comparisons led to the arrest of Dreyfus, even though his handwriting was by no means identical to that which was discovered on the letter. At the trial, the letter was bolstered with a secret collection of papers that was submitted to the judges only, in order to protect the affairs of the French state. Dreyfus was a Jew, nevertheless, so let's accuse him. He was incarcerated and sent to Devil's Island. Now, interestingly, 2 years later, another letter was intercepted. This time, Dreyfus was on Devil's Island. It was the same handwriting. How did this letter get out there? It didn't come from his hand. So after investigations within the military, they found out that it was Major Esterhazy. Major Esterhazy was carrying out some hazy business and sharing this information with the Germans. But the army was not ready to admit that it had made an error. Ever heard of that before? And thus they forged new evidence to strengthen the case against Dreyfus. Esterhazy was actually found out and taken to court, but amazingly found innocent. Dreyfus was tried again 5 years after his original trial in 1894. He went to trial in 1899 with irrefutable evidence of his innocence, and yet once again he was pronounced guilty. It was not until 1906 that a new prime minister or president of France took over the country, and Dreyfus was reinstated his full rank and was awarded the Medal of the Legion of Honor. Now, however inhumane this case was, the man was 39 when he was released, arrested, you know, back 12 years before when he was 27 years old. He had already balded. He was extremely gaunt at the time of his release. So it took an incredible toll upon his life. But no matter how inhumane the case, it gave rise to the political movement known as Zionism under a man named Theodor Herzl. Herzl said this, I want to quote a long, long quote here, what he has to say. He said, "What made me into a Zionist was the Dreyfus case, the original one in Paris, which I witnessed in 1894. At that time, I was living in Paris as a newspaper correspondent and attended the proceedings of the military court until they were declared secret. I can still see the defendant coming into the hall in his dark artillery uniform trimmed with braid. I still hear him give his credentials, Alfred Dreyfus, captain of artillery, in his affected nasal voice, and also the howls of the mob in the street in front of the École Militaire where he was degraded, still ring unforgettably in my ears. Death, death to the Jews, death to Jews, all because this one was a traitor? But was he really a traitor? I, for one, believed in his innocence because I did not consider a Jewish officer capable of being a traitor to his country. Not that I regarded Jews as better than other human beings, but under these particular circumstances, the whole thing appeared unlikely to me. A wealthy man had nothing to gain for doing it, who had chosen this career only through ambition, simply could not have committed the most dishonorable of all crimes. The Dreyfus case contains, however, more than a miscarriage of justice. It contains the wish of the vast majority in France to damn one Jew, and through him, all Jews. Death to the Jews, the crowd yelled when they ripped the captain's stripes from his uniform. And since that time, down with the Jews has become a battle cry. Where? In France. Remember, we started with Napoleon. In France. In France. In Republican, modern, civilized France. Republican, modern, civilized France. 100 years after the Declaration of the Rights of Man, this took place. Well, like our country, Republican, civilized, and we think nothing of the sort could ever take place in a country that's so Republican and free as we are. And yet, it happened in France, and it does happen. And here, he says, we are at the matter that concerns us. Here we are at the lesson in history that any unprejudiced observer must draw from the Dreyfus case. Up to that time, most of us had believed that the solution to the Jewish question was to be expected from the gradual progress of mankind toward tolerance. We're continually advancing. Surely that will take care of all of our problems. But if, he says, but if an otherwise progressive, surely highly civilized people could come to such a pass, that is the French, what was there to be expected from other people who even today are not at the height at which the French have already been for 100 years? This was written, of course, in 1890s. And so, the soon-to-be leader of Zionism was born, and Jews were fleeing from Russia and Western Europe at great rapidity. Some of them went east to Palestine at this early of a time. Most went to the British domains where they could be protected or have some freedom. But above all, most came to the United States of America. America offered freedom. Our Constitution makes a special point to the individual's right to the pursuit of happiness. President Calvin Coolidge later said, the Jewish faith is predominantly the faith of liberty. So he saw it as fitting or harmonizing with the American Constitution of the United States, which promotes freedom. The early history of Jews in America is one of individuals rather than of communities. And I've selected some of the history from individuals here in the state of Texas that I'll explain now. In Texas alone, one learns of pioneers like Adolphus Stern. These are all Jews, who fought in the war against Mexico and later became a member of the Texan Congress. Another, David S. Kaufman, a graduate of Princeton College, who was also elected to the Texas legislature. Moses Albert Levy, who served as Surgeon General in Sam Houston's army. And many, many others. So America became a haven for Jews, and they've enjoyed more freedom in the United States of America than in any other nation for the last 2,500 years. But Herzl was fully convinced that after the Dreyfus case, no matter how great America is, so no matter how great a haven it may be, or other countries possibly in the future, he remained convinced that the Jews could never assimilate or exist as a nation within a nation. Yet, at the same time, there was a need for unity among the Jewish people. They were divided, and some people held that we should continue to try to assimilate. And others said, no, we should not. And so there was a lot of different opinions. Out of this grew the movement called Zionism, a political movement that sought freedom and an independent state in her ancient homeland. Attempts during the early 1900s and late 1800s were made to move the Jews to lands in Argentina. In 1903, a British officer suggested Uganda as a Jewish settlement. But the Palestine ideal alone reflected the age-old yearnings of the Jewish people. Nothing would do except the land of Palestine. This was in accord with the centuries-old recitation at Passover, where every year at Passover they would say, no matter where they were in the world, next year at Jerusalem. Next year at Jerusalem. Now the forerunners to Herzl and his movement were a man named Moses Hess and another man named Leon Pinsker. Leon Pinsker was a Russian Jew who wrote a book about the brutal massacres occurring in Russia. There were over 4 million Jews in Russia, and they underwent what are called pogroms, where the Russians would just go through and blitzkrieg massacre these people. And so these two great events, the Dreyfus case and the pogroms in Russia, led to Zionism. Together, these two events worked, or God worked through these events, to implant within the hearts and minds of the Jews a desire to return to their ancient homeland, Eretz Israel. Now, in 1897, we've got to recall that the fact that the land was under the rule of the Ottoman Turks. A significant Jewish community had already been established there without the approval of the Turks. In that same year, 1897, Herzl called the first Zionist Congress, where he said this. It was held at Basel, Switzerland, 1897. He said, "At Basel, I created the Jewish state. In 5 years, perhaps, and certainly in 50, everyone will see it." That was in 1897. Now you add 50 to 1897, and what year do you come to? 1947. So he was only 1 year off of seeing this statement realized. For Herzl, anti-Semitism, I'll tell you a little bit about Herzl. Herzl, when he was a young man, a very brilliant man, very energetic man, struggled because of his desires to see things come to pass, and yet he wanted them to come to pass faster than they could actually come to pass with all the political issues involved. But anti-Semitism began to trouble him immensely. The Jewish question, what are we going to do with all these Jews, began to haunt him. The Dreyfus affair, which I read to you earlier, horrified him. And all his energy and all his money and all of his labor were then spent to bring about the first Zionist Congress. Now this is significant. The first Zionist Congress in 1897 is extremely significant because it was the first worldwide gathering of Jews since the dispersion. 2,500 years. Had representatives come from Africa and South America and North America and Russia, all together for this first Zionist Congress. 197 came to talk about the Jewish question and what we will do. And Herzl was at the center stage of it all. When people arrived, they were presented with a flag, white, with two blue stripes and the Star of David. Herzl believed that a flag was important for men to unite under and to be led under into the Promised Land. He also adopted a national anthem, the Hatikvah, The words in English mean the hope. His energies were poured into talking to leaders all over the world to try to help him establish the state of Israel. But unfortunately, he died of pneumonia. His dreams unrealized at age 44, but his memory not forgotten. 6,000 Jews attending this hero's funeral. But failing to establish a Jewish state, he did not fail in the long run. He had lit a fire in the hearts of the Jewish people. And in 1949, when his dreams were realized, his body was dug up and reinterred on a hill overlooking Jerusalem, now named Mount Herzl. Now this brings us to another great figure at the time, Chaim Weizmann. And he is the one who picked up Herzl's dreams and carried them forward. He was a brilliant Jewish scientist. He lived in Britain, and he was friends with many of the people on the uppity-up political ladder. For example, he helped Lloyd George, who was later Prime Minister, in the development of acetone during World War I to help with the war effort. But the man who became the key to Chaim Weizmann's labors was a man named Lord Balfour, or Arthur James Balfour, a British. He met him in 1906, and originally, when they met, their first conversation had to do with whether the Jews should move to Uganda or not. And Balfour came to convince Weizmann that Uganda is where the Jews should move, but he came out of the discussion having been convinced by Weizmann that no other thing would do except for Palestine. And so, Balfour became an ardent supporter of Zionism. And without Balfour, there would have been no hope for the Jewish people. There would be no state of Israel today. Now, on November 2, 1917, the British Foreign Office issued this declaration in the form of a letter to Lord Rothschild, a member of the House of Lords. It says this. It came from Balfour. Dear Lord Rothschild, I have much pleasure in conveying to you, on behalf of His Majesty's government, the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations, which has been submitted to and approved by the Cabinet. It reads as follows. His Majesty's government views with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. I should be grateful if you would bring this declaration to the knowledge of the Zionist Federation. Yours sincerely, Arthur James Balfour. So this document now became the motivating force and the key political victory for the Jews of that day in getting a state of Israel. Just 1 month later, this declaration led to Palestine invading what was then Palestine, which was then under Ottoman rule, and defeating them in just 1 month. So that the rule of the Promised Land came out from the Ottoman Turks and was now under the British. Sometime later, when Lloyd George became Prime Minister, he said to Weizmann, "Now you have your state. It's up to you to win the race." The League of Nations conferred the declaration on Britain in 1922. The Balfour Declaration is the decisive diplomatic victory of the Jewish people in modern history. Yet it was no more than an opportunity, because it was up to them to make sure everything came to pass. And Weizmann became widely seen and respected among all the leaders of the world as virtually on level at the level of a president of the State of Israel, even though there was no president at the time. But he was highly respected. Following this, and during this whole period, let me just let you know that there were waves of immigration. Either the first Aliyah, the second Aliyah, they're called Aliyahs, waves of immigration of people back to Palestine. They had the first, they had the second, they had the third, they had the fourth, they had the fifth. And during this time, a large amount of people were going to Israel. The only thing that was troubling was, how are we going to unify all these people that are coming from all over the world, different countries from which they've come? How are we going to unify them all under one flag? How are we going to unify the people? Well, the Zionist movement said that the way to unify them is by the ancient Hebrew language. We will bring them all to a common language. This will bind us to the ancient land and to the ancient language of our ancient fathers. And so, one man, Eliezer ben Yehuda, dedicated his entire life to the revival of the Hebrew language as being the vehicle of Jewish life. Now, when they got there to the land, this place was a wreck. It was swamps everywhere, malarial infested, extremely hazardous place to live in. And so they began to build roads, they drained the swamps, they converted the land into a flourishing and productive country. And between the years of 1917, when the Balfour Declaration was made, and the year of 1939, which was the beginning of World War II, the population grew from 55,000 to 450,000. There were times it is said that when the men went hungry, so the cattle could eat. And their favorite way of explaining why they would not eat and they would let the cattle eat was this. They'd say, "We are Zionists, but our cows are not." Now, between the wars, World War I and World War II, 1917 and 1939, the British mandate was supposed to set up the British in control over the land of Palestine in order to ultimately facilitate the development of a Jewish state, correct? That's what the Balfour Declaration declared. However, there were some other people who became interested in the land a bit later. You've got to remember that the Ottoman Empire extended over many of the ancient Arab habitats as well, such as Iraq and even down into areas of Syria. So when the Ottoman Empire fell, all of a sudden the Arabs were also interested in a national home, just like the Jews were interested in a national home. Now, early on, they made no attempts at the land of Palestine to bring it under their control. And the reason was because they hesitated because they knew that they had no ancient claims on the land. But they did have ancient claims on land such as Iraq, Transjordan, and Saudi Arabia. And they were given this big Arab state, huge amount of area. However, by 1936, the Arabs had not secured their big Arab state. And so the British took it over. Thus, the Arabs began to claim Palestine as theirs and totally resisted a Jewish national home. This is when the turn really comes to become anti-Israel among the Arabs. Quickly, all the leading Arab families who were all Muslim agreed on one point. They demanded the abolition of the Jewish national home, the abolition of the Balfour Declaration, and the establishment of an Arab independent state in Palestine. Their case was built on this point. Sovereignty belonged to Arabs, and wherever they were, and to Jews, nowhere at all. That's their case. Arab nationalism and Zionism were henceforward locked in mortal combat, and they are to this day. The British began to back off from the Balfour Declaration and began to obstruct and later repress the Jews because of their interest in helping the Arabs, who were a much larger people at the time. And the British often did nothing when guerrilla warfare attacks happened between the Israelites and the Jews, and the Arabs, or they even sided often with the Arabs. So the relationship between the British and the Jews came to a virtual breaking point. And the year 1939, the same year that the war began, with the publication of the White Paper. This document drastically limited immigration. In other words, people couldn't come back. They were going to limit. In other words, you've got an open door there, and now we're going to close the door, and only so many people can get into the state of Israel. It also determined to hand all the land over to an Arab government, and the Jews would be ruled by them. This resulted in the first open conflict between the British and the Jews, whom had initially agreed to help them establish a Jewish state. But the British aim of keeping tranquility among the Arabs was far too great, political pressure. During World War II, for example, ships loaded with survivors of the Holocaust were sent back to the blood-stained ground of Europe many of them, to concentration camps in Germany. One ship, for example, was turned back at the port on the way up in the Black Sea. And when it was turned back, after struggling in the water, it sunk and more than 700 Jews drowned. So it was looking as if the state of Israel would never be founded at all. During this time, of course, Israel had to establish small military groups, which would later be an advantage when they were attacked in 1948, 56 and 57, 67 and 73, and for all the other smaller attacks. But they developed several small groups, some of them known as the Irgun, the Haganah, and the Palmach. And these were all small groups, individualized, separate groups designed to protect themselves from the Arabs. And also they did carry out attacks on the Arabs themselves. These would later all be united under one banner, and you know them today as the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces. And I'm unsure of the Americans' role in that, but I think that there is probably a strong role by a man named Colonel Mickey Marcus, who was an American Jew who went over to help in the establishment of the State of Israel. There's a movie about this if you ever want to watch it, if you're a John Wayne fan. There's several. Yul Brynner's in it. Fred Astaire's in it. Or no, Frank Sinatra, I'm sorry. Frank Sinatra. And Kurt Douglas. And it's a movie called Cast a Giant Shadow. And it explains the story. It's very historically accurate. It's a good movie. Now, so this brings us to the time after the white paper of World War II and the Holocaust. We'll spend the rest of the time on this. Then, people back in the homeland of Israel got the horrifying news of the Holocaust. Now, smaller persecutions of Jews came before 1939 in Germany, but the final solution to the Jewish question came in that year, 1939. The most terrible things happened after 1941. In June 1941, Hitler broke his pact with the Russian Stalin, and he marched into Russia. At once, the Jewish population in these invaded territories was systematically exterminated. Jews were rounded up, shot on the spot, and dumped into common graves. Jews were forced to gather their brethren from their local towns, and then they were herded onto trucks and freight cars, taken outside the town to some ravine or ditch, stripped of all their valuables and clothing, and then men, women, and children were shot. The countryside became an immense graveyard, drenched in the blood of innumerable anonymous corpses. Other methods of execution employed were mass drownings, burnings, and gassings in mobile gas chambers, usually disguised as convoy trucks. The final blow took place in the concentration camps, of course, where Jews were stripped of everything they possessed, including hair, gold teeth, and false limbs. Even their bones were turned into phosphate and their fat into soap. Now, thousands of German nationals became rich from the pillage. In the words of one German nationalist, Himmler, "We have written a glorious page in our history, a story which should never be told. We have taken everything they owned." Hoss, the camp commander of Auschwitz, stated at his post-war trial, "I commanded Auschwitz until December the 1st, 1943, and estimate that at least 2.5 million victims were executed and exterminated there by gassing and burning, and at least another 500,000 succumbed to starvation and disease, making a total dead of about 3 million people. We executed about 400,000 Hungarian Jews alone at Auschwitz in the summer of 1944. What would happen is when you arrived at Auschwitz, either you were chosen or you were rejected, right off the spot. If you were chosen for labor, then the average lifespan of these individuals was 3 months. If not, then you went straight to your death if you weren't chosen. You were led to think that you were going to have a shower, and after undressing, you were handed a bar of soap. The gas chambers had simulated shower heads coming out of the ceiling. Once he walked in and they closed the doors, then canned Zyklon B, a gas, was dropped through little windows in the ceiling. The asphyxiation process took about 3 to 10 minutes. After 30 minutes, the bodies would be removed, guess by who? Jews, who had been selected to clean out the chambers, search the bodies, and then bury them or take them to the crematoria where they would be burned. The ashes would be loaded onto trucks or dumped into ditches, and it was all part of a long-term plan that had been developed as early as 1933 and was carried out systematically. Now, to read the documentation of this from the German records is to enter into a world of horror and almost unbelief at what people could do. Until the Nazi Holocaust, there was an innocent assumption in the world that somehow when you looked upon a child, the innocence and the fragility of a child, that it just caused hesitation before doing anything and the ability to hurt a child. The human race can no longer allow itself even this consolation. Here are the words of the Eternal General at the Eichmann trial in Jerusalem in 1961. Before they presented the case, he said, "We shall present you with the instructions about the transport of children. The children were to be divided among transports intended for Auschwitz. Children of 14 were considered independent for purposes of transport to the extermination camps. Nor shall we say who suffered the more terrible fate, those who died or those who concealed themselves in every conceivable hiding place, who lived in perpetual terror of expulsion, who survived by the grace of Christian neighbors who agreed to hide them. Children would come home from the schools and centers organized by the community to find their parents' home empty, for they had been sent by some special operation to their deaths, and the apartment was in the meantime occupied by others. You will hear evidence," he says, "of tender infants pressed by their mothers to their bodies in the gas chambers, so that they were not immediately poisoned until the executioners came and threw them alive into the furnaces." Now, after the Holocaust, the numbers. Before the Holocaust, there were 16 million Jews, approximately, on the planet. During the Holocaust, some estimate, say, as little as 4.1 million. Others as many as 6 million killed. Neither is a little number. I mean, come on. Either way, it's completely inexcusable, and there is no doubt that the extermination was carried out by thousands and not just a limited few, but thousands. And so it can only have been carried out by those thoroughly convinced of the Aryan ideology. This had been thoroughly indoctrinated in them through years of propaganda advancing the Aryan myth. But that does not, of course, remove responsibility. Now, it has taken 60 years for the population of Israel in the world to rise to 15 million, not even what it was in the year 1939. Well, coupling this fact with the fact of the white paper, which had been published by the British in 1939, it came out the fact that no Jews after the Holocaust could return to the land of Palestine, a seeming total stupidity. But the world, after watching this horror, was pricked in its conscience to the point where I believe that this was their only moment of opportunity to get the world behind them and to give them an opportunity at becoming a nation. All of the pieces were in the only places, the perfect places that they could be. In fact, the Russians were even mad at the Arabs for about 3 months. And it happened to be in those 3 months that Israel pronounced to be a state. And Russia actually was the second to recognize them as a state, the United States being the first. And that, too, was a miracle because everybody on the cabinet was against recognizing Israel as a state. But one man, Harry S. Truman, was for it. And so Harry S. Truman got his way, being the first to recognize Israel as a state. After Israel pronounced its statehood on May the 14th, 1948, Within 2 or 3 months, Russia was anti-Israel again and pro-Arab, and persecuted by supplying weapons to the Arabs for many, 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 many years. And this is one of the reasons, basically, that I believe that the United States won the Cold War during the period of Reagan. It is not simply because of all sorts of political gains, but is ultimately what's behind it, is driving it, is the Abrahamic covenant. Those who bless me, I will bless. Those who bless you, they will be cursed. And so God is working out this principle among the nations today. And if America pulls her hand from Israel, then I only fear what will happen next to us. Let us go to the Lord in prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for this study in the nation of Israel. The fact that it is a careful and beautiful story of your eternal security of this nation, your faithfulness to your promises. We pray, Lord, that as a nation, we would not turn our back on the apple of your eye, but that we would bless them, that we would pray for the salvation of the Jews and for the peace of Jerusalem. And we pray for your soon coming and the grand consummation of your plans in your kingdom. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.